You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. Elevating the Dialogue, Overcoming Today's Intellectual Abyss with Sargon of Akkad and Greg Salmieri. Recorded live in London on October 12th, 2018.
I think that the current sort of progressive regime is not only failing to encompass various communities and types of people that are being underserved in society in general, but they're in many ways actively suppressing these people and in fact demonizing them as being the root cause of society's ills. And I think that when you start pointing to a single race or gender and saying these are the people who are causing all the problems, then you're going down a path that probably isn't worth following and probably isn't going to come to any kind of solution, especially when the radical activists force us to move venues. Because, you know, as high risk as I am, I actually think I'm not the thing that's the risk. I think it's the people whose flag I took who are the risk. I'm kind of disappointed I won't be able to get a second one today. But
Well, the night's young.
What do you think?
No, I think that's right. So we've seen, and this is not something that's new, but it's something that's renewed in America and in, I think, England and Western Europe. In the 60s, there was a rise of things that were allegedly speech and were allegedly getting ideas across, but were really violence and were really taking over public spaces, were shouting down people who had opinions different from you, were not engaged in spreading radical ideas through discourse and conversation, but were a kind of bullying. And I think a lot of the new left movement of the mid-60s was starting to morph into that. Certainly the riots that you got at Columbia and places later were that. And that, for whatever reason, reduced to a simmer for some decades. We could think about why. I don't really know that much about why. But it's really come back in force in the last decade or so. And I've had, we have the example of Occupy, the Occupy movement, which was just taking over places, a number of universities where the administration buildings were occupied and so forth. And then this trend of shouting down speakers, which I first became aware of with some of my friends that were shouted down and deplatformed, and it's happened to you and to you in Iran, and it's something you have to live with a lot. And some other people, I've not encountered this directly myself yet, I'm fortunate enough to be able to say, but a number of people I've shared stages with or know have had this issue. And it's, again, it's a kind of thuggery usurping the realm of ideas.
There's no doubt it's a kind of thuggery, that's the point. The whole point is deliberately to intimidate. I mean, you don't burst into someone else's auditorium wearing a black mask and yelling with a gang of people if you're not trying to intimidate them. That's the sole purpose of the thing. But it is genuinely to shut down the discourse, because the problem they have is that they think they have some kind of received wisdom. This is the problem I have with the far left at the moment. They are acting as if God himself has come down and said progressive ideals are the only ideals, everyone else is actually a tool of Satan, and now you must go out and go forth and shut them down by any means necessary, which, unironically, are words they use. So, I mean, at the end of the day, we can either endure that or we can stand up and try and have conversations and around them and try and show them we're not going to be cowed by this, we're not afraid of them, and that these things have to happen. And ultimately, they haven't got the perfect solution to anything. And like all ideas, their ideas aren't just going to, you know, stay frozen in ice. They're going to have to continue to evolve and incorporate other methods of thought that they might not particularly like.
One thing that's worth thinking about here is if we're thinking about the left as a force for against that's chilling speech and chilling discussions of ideas, is how to think of the constitution of the left in this sense. Because there's a certain contingent, the Antifa mobs and so forth, who are coming and actually trying to shut down events. How do we think of this in relation to more mainstream leftist sources? Because there are some that, well, one, most of them don't actually engage in that, right?
Yes, yeah.
There are some that have actually called it out, right? So Barack Obama, for example, who I'm no fan of, I should stress, but did criticize the movement of deplatforming Even Noam Chomsky, who's really far left, has criticized things like Antifa.
Well, just to interrupt that, I mean, have you noticed that the way that Noam Chomsky criticizes them, though? He always says things like, oh, Antifa are a gift to the right. Mm-hmm. He's never saying that in principle they're doing anything wrong. He's never suggesting that they're taking a moral action. He's purely talking from a strategic position of this hurts our opponents, this helps our opponents, and this hurts our own cause. It's not that he's suggesting they're doing anything wrong, and that's one of the main problems I have with Noam Chomsky in this, because it's an entirely... I mean, these people, I think they would describe themselves broadly as anarchists and some variant of communists, and they've got very, you know, very detailed and very fine delineations between each group. But really, they're all on the same team, and they know it, and they all work together. And ultimately, it's completely deconstructionist. They want to. They don't believe that any kind of hierarchy can be justified, which is hilarious because, like, Vice magazine did a sort of walk around interview with a group of Antifa in Portland, and one of the complaints that they had was that the women were in the kitchen making Molotov cocktails. This is middle class students in Portland, while the men were out in the garden practicing how to throw them, and. If the anarchists, the ultimate, you know, anti-hierarchical feminists, communist types, if they can't get rid of the patriarchy in their own spaces, what chance do they have in the entire rest of the world, you know?
Yeah, and if their whole way of thinking is so captured by this focus on hierarchies that they're, you know, eating themselves with it, which is what I think you're seeing now on the left, there's still... So if we take the worst groups, right, the ones that are actually violent, I think it's worth thinking about how they relate to the groups that are still bad or still have a lot of ideas that each of us would disagree with, and maybe we'll disagree with different ones, I don't know.
Sure.
But how should we understand their relation to the violent groups? And so in the case of Chomsky, for example, who's not someone who advocates violence, I think it's a really good point that he doesn't advocate it because he doesn't think it's the best technique.
Yeah.
That is definitely a significant point. In the case of Obama, I don't think that, at least that's not what he says,
I believe Obama's a center-leftist. So
yeah,
I believe that fundamentally he probably did hold to liberal axioms at the very bottom. You know, when you got down to it, he probably thinks that violence, you know, unprovoked violence, it probably is a moral wrong. You know?
That's my sense of him, too. I don't think he's a...
No, he's not a communist.
Right, a communist or an anarchist. He's a center Democratic Party guy that moved the Democratic Party a little more in this direction.
Sure.
Than his predecessors, but not way in this direction.
Yeah.
But what about, so something like Ezra Klein, I mean, I'm thinking of the interview, the Sam Harris Ezra Klein discussion, where they were about Harris's having had an interview with Murray and, or whatever, a podcast with Murray. And what I found there was, and what I found with some subset of the liberal academics I know, is saying, yeah, this is a problem, students going overboard, as they would put it, on campus and doing this, and they shouldn't be violent, and that should be reined in. It is a problem, I'm against it, but it's being blown out of proportion.
Yeah.
So there are people who say they don't support it, probably really don't support it, and would discourage their students from doing it, but they're soft on the issue, and I think that's a real problem.
I completely agree. The main thing in my mind that separates the U.S. Republican Party from the Democratic Party is that the Republican Party has no dealings with the radical fringe of the right wing. They don't have white identitarians in the Republican Party. You know, they kick these things out. Whereas the Democratic Party is quite happy to allow communists to operate within their ranks. I mean, socialism is currently creeping and taking over the Democratic Party. I saw a statistic the other day, something like when polled, 57% of Democrats thought socialism was a good idea. It's like, these people not had an education or something. Mm. But this is the problem, because I think it's the way that the argumentation goes. Because it's all done on moral lines when you come down to these sort of fine ideological points. And it becomes like who is the purest and most socialist and most committed to the cause? And these people's voices become amplified. You see it with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She is like the party line on democratic socialism. And when she came out saying, oh, I want everyone to be guaranteed a job working for the government for $15 an hour, I can't believe that the Republicans didn't freak out at the very idea. I mean, what does she think that's going to do to the market? That's socialism by any other means, because what she's going to do is poach all of the workers from private enterprises that pay, that can't afford to pay $15 an hour to the government, and what's going to happen to them? Their industries are going to collapse. And now the government is saddled with all these skilled workers who are going to need jobs. What are they going to do? They're going to have to set up, you know, sheet metal producing or something. Okay, well, the government's going to have to create a factory to produce sheet metal. It's seizing the means of production by another method. It's unbelievably underhanded. And I didn't see Republicans freaking out about it. And I'm just sat here like...
So I did see a pretty big reaction to her.
Oh, no, it wasn't. There was a big reaction to her, but there was no reaction to her proposals in that way. And that was something I really felt. I felt that the right wing had kind of missed a beat there, because effectively what she's suggesting is Venezuela 2.0. You know, and it's unbelievable how much this is going to cost in tax, how many entrepreneurs it's going to ruin.
And that it's
and nobody
wrong.
Cared. And that it's morally wrong, you know, but nobody cared and nobody made a big stink about it.
I mean, one of my issues with the right in America is that it doesn't have anything to say, or it hasn't for a very long time. And I don't think of myself as on the right or the left in America. I think of myself as something separate. But I don't think the people who oppose socialism have had an alternative system they were in favor of. And if you think of Obamacare, I think of this as an example of it. In the States, there was a proposal in the 90s, right? Hillary Clinton, when she was the first lady, was in charge of it, to more or less socialize American healthcare, create something more like you guys have here. And it was very unpopular, right? It got voted down. The doctors were very much against it. There was nobody thought the way healthcare was run in America was great at the time. But there was a pretty big consensus that this would have been a move in the wrong direction. And they lost. And then the Democrats lost the midterm elections. You had Republicans in Congress. And you had, this is the mid-90s, all the way until 2008, from when Hillary Care was voted down to when Obamacare got voted in. And what were the Republicans doing in that time on health care? There was a sense that something had to be done to change it. The Republicans had won the battle that this isn't the thing to do to change it. And there were no actual free market policies that were being proposed to reform healthcare in a different direction than more socialism. A couple of organizations floated some, and there are particular ones we could talk about, but none of them got traction with the Republican candidates. The party wasn't pushing it. The more mainstream think tanks in the party were pushing basically the ideas that later became Obamacare, and then Obamacare got signed in. And what happened after Obamacare got signed in? All the Republicans rallied against Obamacare, hating on Obama and Obamacare, but didn't have a proposal of what they actually wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so they repealed it however many dozen times when they couldn't get it through because the president wouldn't sign it. And as soon as we have now a Republican Congress and a Republican president, they can't really get rid of it because they don't know what they want to have instead of it. They tinker around the sides of it. So they're not, the Republicans can't come out strong against socialist policies because they don't have an alternative to socialist policies that they're for. They can make fun of the more egregious statements, but that's really, sadly, all they're good for in economics, you see.
It's not just economics either. I think that people need to remember that society is a thing, and I think a lot of people try to pretend like it's not, and we can just ignore the current social issues that are going on and focus on economic problems. I mean, you know, there is more to life than economics. And it's not just the lack of solutions economically to these problems. You know, what's your alternative to Obamacare? In this country, it drives me crazy that every time I see Theresa May do something, she is effectively enacting Jeremy Corbyn's policies. And it drives me nuts. I mean, like, when Theresa May has finished being Prime Minister, she'll probably vote Labour. and I'm really annoyed by it, because it's not that she... I mean, for example, right, the NHS. The other day, the Conservatives came out, oh, we're going to put 20 billion new into the NHS It's like, yeah, that was the Labour manifesto, but how about we actually get a cap on the amount we need to put in the NHS by, say, reducing mass immigration? Because we still have, under the Conservatives, we've had 250,000 people a year coming into the country. I mean, that's a city the size of Swindon every year, you know, coming into this country. It's like, no wonder we need 20 billion extra on healthcare, but it comes down to, and it really does come down to, you can have social services that work and are affordable, or you can have open borders, and you've got to make the choice. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I do quite well, so I could probably afford private services. I'm fine with that. But the question is, okay, can working class communities in the north of England afford that? No, not a chance in hell. You say you're going to take away the NHS, they're rioting. You know, they're coming for you. And so you've got to accept that's a facet of reality that we have to deal with. So how do we keep the NHS afloat? Well, we're going to have to keep increasing taxes then. Because for some reason, we're ideologically incapable of closing the borders. And
I mean, one of the problems, I think, with welfare state programs, and the NHS is one of them, is that they are inflexible, difficult to change in these kinds of situations. I think that's a consequence of their being morally wrong. But we can talk about that. And they create a situation where people then have to band together into tribes against one another. So there are lots of other things that might be relevant to deciding what the proper immigration should be, a policy should be, and how many people should be let in and in what situation. But if the reason to want to be closing the borders is, or restricting immigration further, is, well, we can't afford these health services for people, right? That is creating a situation where having a part of your economy managed by your government creates a situation in which people are pitted against each other who needn't be. There might be other reasons, totally apart from that, about cultural fit and crime and so forth, to be worried about immigration. But that type of reason, I think, is a consequence of a type of policy that I think is wrong independent of this. And this is, we can talk about whether families in the north of England would be able to afford health care without the NHS.
It's not even necessarily whether they would actually... the reality of it is a lot less important, in my opinion, than the perception of it. Mm. And at the end of the day, you're not going to be able to remove the perception that, you know, from them, that they think they're going to get screwed. You know,
Well, but part of how you'd have to remove that perception, if you were going to try to, and part of how you would, in America or in the UK or anywhere else, have to propose an alternative to whatever trends are going on, is to pitch a positive vision of what life could and should be like, what our end game is, what our view of a better type of society is, and then to talk about what healthcare would look like in that kind of society, and then what incremental reforms would get us from here to there. And it would have to be a vision that was capable of inspiring people. And I think there are what people who favor free markets, as I do, and favor what I think of as a truly free society, a society in which the government is separated from running the economy in the same way that, at least according to the U.S. Constitution, if not always in reality, it's separated from religion. If you want to have that kind of government, if you think that that's right, you need to really pitch a vision of what that is, what it would look like in every area of life, and then what incremental changes to get there would be. And that's what I think the real alternative to socialist policies are. And I mean, in the UK, you had Thatcher, who was the closest to that and was one of the few politicians in the world, really, who made a significant change in a positive direction. And I think she did a fair amount of that, but not enough, in my view.
Thatcher's got a horrific reputation in certain areas of Britain, but there's no denying that what she did was inevitable. You know, it was either happened now or it was happening later. So, you know, you can argue that she didn't do it well, she wasn't compassionate to the communities that she affected, but at the end of the day, the coal mining industry was going down. There's no saving it. But I think the most important thing to remember is the socialists win not because their economic policies are sound, obviously. They win not because the longevity of the cause that they're championing, obviously. They don't win because of the lack of oppression or the raise in living standards. They win because socialism is effectively a religion. Socialism is now a moral position. It's not an economic position. It's not a philosophy of the right way to live your life. It is the moral impetus of socialism that they bank on everywhere, all the time. Don't you care about X? And you've got to provide a severe and I mean, it's you have to provide an unbelievably firm moral grounding for anything you're going to approach this with in opposition, because otherwise they will think of you as some kind of bad person who wants to hurt other people, and you can't get around that. So you've got to. It's as you have to have a really firm theory of how you're going to get to this other place, and it has to be completely watertight. And at the moment, the Republicans don't have that. And I wonder, and not just Republicans, but the Conservatives as well, and I genuinely wonder why. It seems that they're almost incapable of making moral arguments from a secular perspective. And I think the increasing sort of irreligiosity of Western society is really hamstringing them in this position. It seems that they're not sure where to build, the base on which to build. And I think the socialists are taking advantage of that.
Well, so one question is, why does socialism have this moral high ground? Right? And I think the reason is because of the widespread moral beliefs of the West, and of the whole world, rather.
Yes.
So it's not that socialism came out of nowhere. Ayn Rand, who I guess I've not mentioned yet, so I should, In an early note she was making to herself, described Christianity as the perfect kindergarten for communism. And I think it is. If you think that you have to love your brother as yourself, if you think that every person is the same, not just in their rights, but in the extent, that you should treat them just as you treat yourself and just as you treat your loved ones, if you think that you should turn the other cheek when you're attacked, if you think that how you treat the least person is how you treat God, because everyone's a part of God, not just, again, in being a human being and having rights, but in deserving to live as well as everyone else does, regardless of what choices they make, and regardless of how they lead their lives, and regardless of what they contribute to your life, then the logic of that kind of a morality ultimately leads to something like socialism. And I think it's not just and specifically Christianity. There's a lot of philosophy that comes in between the Bible and our current ways of thinking about morality. But I think a germ of it is there. And I think a germ of it is in most tribal societies, in most religion, all tribal societies, all religions. And it was through various strands we could talk about in the history of philosophy, kind of refined and developed and made more virulent. And the way it exists now is in the idea that what makes you morally good is the extent to which you're willing to give up, to give of yourself, to sacrifice, to undergo harms or risks to yourself, to help others. Not that it's sometimes good to do that, or that there are some things good about that, which whether or not that's true we could talk about, but that is the judge of your character. That is what's good about you. And if that's right, then I think there isn't any moral grounds to argue against socialism.
Well, okay, so I think, that's a very interesting set of ideas you've laid out there. I agree that Christianity undoubtedly does have this impetus, a kind of, I guess we could call it a social impetus, but I think the most important thing to remember about Christianity is that Jesus specifically didn't expect the state to do this. It's one thing to have a moral compass of your own where you think, okay, I, with my own free action, my own free agency, I'm going to do some sort of charity, give of yourself to others in whatever way you think is good and moral and will improve the world around you. That's one thing. But the trouble is the state, when the state gets involved, it is a legal method of compulsion that is backed by force. And so now you're imposing this moral standard on other people. It's one thing to have it. It's another thing to impose it, I think. I think that there is never going to be a situation where you can persuade the public at large that self-sacrifice and altruism, moral, like charity, virtue, all this sort of thing. I don't think you're ever going to be able to persuade them. There's never going to be a time where you can persuade them that this is not a moral position and a good thing. I think the key has to be how this is done. Because this is the great gift of liberalism, is to separate the state from society and allow society to put chains of law on the state to prevent them from tyrannizing the individual. And this is, I think that is the moral route from which we can launch at them, I'm happy to agree that, I'm not an objectivist. I'm happy to agree that doing things for others, it is a good thing for you to do. It will be widely perceived as moral. But then the compulsion using the state, the sort of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez perspective, I do view that as deeply immoral because ultimately I don't have a choice. So I really think that that's the route that we can, the sort of crack that we can use as a crowbar to leverage it apart. You know, it's not that it's not moral. And the thing that drives me wild is the Labour Party in this country is the largest party, like 550,000 people, and they're constantly begging the government for more and more power and more tyrannical power. And I'm just sat there thinking, if you guys just stopped with politics and did the charity you wanted to do, you probably would solve all the problems you're actually concerned about. You don't actually need the state to do these things. It's within your power. You're free to organise, you know, especially in Britain, it's, you know, famously like clubbable thing. Create a vast nationwide network of charities and things. And you guys, you know, I mean, there would be no argument against it. But instead, I'm sat here saying, look, the Labour Party is a moral wrong and will bring in a tyrannical regime that will destroy this country in the same way that Maduro has destroyed Venezuela. You know, it doesn't have to be that way, but at the moment, that's what the Labour Party is.
And in the way that Labour did nearly destroy the country
in the 70s,
And prior to, I mean, in the aftermath of World War II, the 70s were the nadir of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, my father grew up in the late 60s and 70s, and he has voted Conservative his whole life. And I never really understood this until when I was in my 20s. He was sat there going, look, you have to understand what the situation was like. I mean, people were working three-day weeks. The electricity was off for 2 days a week. Rubbish was piling up in the streets, and everyone was losing money. You know, the Labour Party was ruining the country, demonstrably so. And Jeremy Corbyn is just preaching the same thing. So why anyone would even vaguely support Jeremy Corbyn on an economic level is insane, but it's not an economic level, it's a moral level. He sits there beating his little bird chest going, this is it right? Jeremy, being a socialist is not right. Just sit down and be quiet.
So let's think about, though, why it's not right, right? Because I think the point you made is what's central to the classical liberal tradition, I think, is exactly right. This idea that we separate out society from the government. We separate out what people do as individuals and in groups that aren't the government from what the government does. We separate out what the government is, what we all do together by force. And we think that's a special thing. That's not everything we do.
It's certainly it has to be a special thing.
Yes.
It has to be.
And it has to be treated as that. Mm-hmm. And importantly, and here's how Rand put it, I think it's a really good formulation, we subordinate society to moral law. And subordinate, in particular, government to moral law. So it's not whatever the collective wants it gets, at, you know, and can use force to do it, but rather there's a moral law that's higher than whatever the group wants it gets, a moral law of the needing to respect the individual, needing to respect individual rights, needing to respect the individual's freedom to be free of force, to be free of having things seized from him, to be free of having his life dictated to him. And the government's job is to protect that freedom and never to infringe upon it. And that's what the principle of individual rights, which is the central Lockean principle, yep, and in America the Jeffersonian principle, is about. But then if we want to think about what the morality is that we have to oppose socialism on, we can start with that distinction. But a lot of people don't share that, right? A lot of people don't agree with us that that's important.
It's crazy,
the question is why, right?
Well, I genuinely think that these people think that it's okay. Because, I mean, it's not even necessarily the outcome they're asking for that I object to. It's definitely the procedure of it. And the procedure is always tyrannical government, you know. And you can say, well, I mean, that's an extreme way of phrasing it. It's like, yeah, okay, the first step might in itself not be tyrannical. You know, the next hate speech law might in of itself not be tyrannical. But we're going down a path that 10 steps later is when you start from the original position, you would never choose the 10th step from the original starting point. And, sorry, I didn't interrupt, but it just drives me crazy how they constantly try to reframe things. And it's, at the end of the day, I completely agree with the way you've characterized that.
So I think that's true. There are these slippery slopes, but if they...
I wouldn't call it a slippery slope, okay, because I think what it is not necessarily a slippery slope, but it's just the logical progression of argumentation.
Uh-huh.
You know, as soon as you accept one premise, what stops you from accepting another? I mean, this is the thing. Going back to a point you made earlier, it's like, what's the relation of the moderates to the radicals? And this is a real concern because, I mean, nobody really wants to say it, but how much resistance is there going to be to the burqa and thobe wearing people on the streets if ISIS took over this country? What's their objection to ISIS? And everyone's like, I don't know. Exactly. Because, frankly, the people who do this are religious extremists. There's a reason why a swathe of Muslim countries ban these sort of expressions of extreme religiosity, because they realize this is the entry point to radical Islam, and they don't want to encourage that, obviously. You know, they're trying to run modern secular states, you know. And so the question of, like, with the democratic socialists, do they object to the communists? How can they object to the communists? It's not that they personally, as individuals, say, well, that's too radical for me. But on what grounds are they objecting? They're on the same rails, and they're just, how far down this path are they going to go?
But so if the 10th step is bad, right, which we agree that it is, I think what one has to be able to see why the first step is bad, is not just that it will lead in practice to the 10th, but that the logic of it is that if the first step is right, the 10th step is right too. And once we understand that, we should be able to run that argument in the other direction. Mm-hmm. That is, once we understand why the 10th step is wrong, and obviously wrong, the instituting of a dictatorship, yeah, how the first step is wrong also. We should be able to see a smaller version of that evil of the totalitarianism in the first step. And what then I think one has to try to do, and it's difficult to do, is to take the people who are the moderates, so to speak, the moderate leftists, or in a lot of cases the moderate rightists too, because I think a lot of what's called the right is also advocating for some other form of government that would grow totalitarian, is say, you wouldn't agree with this thing. You think that this small step that you want to take isn't going to lead us there and isn't the same thing. Let me show you how it is. Let me show you not just why it'll have to lead there, but how some of what you can see is bad about dictatorship is also bad about the NHS, is also bad about the progressive income tax, is also bad about whatever the policy is.
Yeah.
And so in the case of the healthcare, right, it's wrong to have government dictate your whole life. Why is it then right for it to dictate? You know, because most people put in as much as they take out of the system on average. That has to be.
I assume they put in more than they take
out.
Yeah,
or more.
Or the system.
Right. Put in at least as much, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So why is it that it's okay for the government to dictate and for society as a whole to dictate how much of your money you spend on your health care versus on something else? Some people are more concerned about health than others. Some people have different preferences for long and short range. And, you know, if you start thinking about what's wrong with dictatorship, you can start to see what's wrong with forced pension plans, what's wrong with lots of things that are not making you a slave your whole life, but are constraining your ability to lead your own life by your own values and by your own judgment.
I think maybe it's because I'm English, and the English have always had a particularly relaxed view towards extremism. I don't know how to explain, but I think most people do certain things like the NHS or a social safety net because they are relatively effective solutions to problems that are quite severe but can be reasonably dealt with. For example, the problem, you know, people becoming homeless when they lose their jobs. You know, a social safety net absolutely prevents that. You know I've had to rely on it myself. You know, so I can say with cast iron certainty that is a way of preventing that problem. And if you have a society that is kind of aware of itself and wants to maintain certain levels of certain standards of living and to be an altruistic society, then that is a compromise that you can make and has been made, obviously, which is why we have them. The question is, who are you compromising with? If we're compromising with like someone who is, can I characterize you as a radical free marketer?
Sure.
Yeah, I didn't think that was unfair.
You characterize me as an extremist if you want.
Well, I
don't mean it as an insult.
I
accept as good terms.
So. Yeah, well, that's the thing. I was called a free speech extremist. And it's like, yes, I would never have coined it myself, but thank you so much. You know, I'm so glad they gave that to me. But this thing, sort of like the more radical free market side, And then you've got the complete statist control of the socialists on the other side. Most people, I think, are more moderate, obviously, because, frankly, I don't think they put that much time thinking into all of these things. And so sort of, if you've got a moderate in the middle, they say, OK, well, you know, it's a small price to pay for a positive net effect, then I'm prepared to do that. And that's fine, as long as we understand that it's a compromise. You know, and you understand that, look, we're doing this because we appreciate the problem, it will solve the problem, and you're not going to go too far. However, then you get the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's of the world, who for them, that's not far enough. And normally it would be incumbent on the moderates from whatever political faction you're dealing with to say, sorry, we've made this compromise for you already. Now you're a wide-eyed lunatic who wants to have the government control of things. You've got to stop. We have to divorce ourselves from you. Your activism has to stop there. But they don't do that, unfortunately. Unfortunately, they keep going because it seems that the people, especially on the centre-left, say, have lost the moral courage to resist these people. And I mean, I'm not saying there's any kind of solution to what I'm saying here. I think that's the sort of realistic view of how these things end up. And so it's not that I disagree with you that, you know, in principle, I mean, it is a compromise. It's definitely a compromise. You know, you're compromising on the principle of absolute freedom to be left alone to do whatever it is you want. But being realistic about it, I think that most people are actually happy to do that. And in a way, they feel that they have done their moral duty to their fellow man. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something you've got to take into account.
Yeah, well, I do think that's what's happening. They do think they're doing their duty to their fellow man. I think their views of what they owe to other people are mistaken. But a bigger part of it, I think, is that they don't really value freedom. And so I think you and I do, right? And it's incomprehensible. Like, why are people unconcerned about this? Why do they not see that rights are important, that individualism is important? But not everybody does. So take, not everyone in Britain does, but certainly not everyone in the world did. You can think about George Bush's idea, right, that if only we go into Iraq and we get rid of Saddam Hussein, all the Iraqis will enact the United States Constitution the next day.
They'll be waving their American flags.
Yeah.
Now,
there was a lot wrong with Bush's foreign policy, but part of it was not everybody wants the same things, right?
No,
and not everybody wants freedom. And if we do, and we want to persuade other people to want it, and if other people maybe want it part way but not all the way, we need to think about what ideas that we've accepted that are deeper than rights and freedom lie behind our valuing freedom. And this is where I think about what it is that makes you think, of course, we can't have a situation where people dictate to us, where things are forced to us. You have to think of yourself as an individual, first of all, primarily as an individual person rather than as a member of a group. You think of yourself primarily as a member of a class or caste, or even family or nation, but primarily as a part of some larger whole. You're going to think that that larger whole, you're going to think of your interests as that whole's interests rather than as your own interests. And you can see that's the whole idea behind all the different kinds of literal Marxism and all the various grievance studies, as it's starting to get called.
Yes.
Where you think I'm primarily part of this tribe, right?
Yeah.
You have to think of yourself as primarily an individual, because it's as an individual that you need freedom. And you have to think about what is it that makes you an individual. And it's the fact that human beings live by reason.
Well,
human beings think.
Sorry to interrupt there. Now, that's the primary goal of the individual is freedom. And I think that's a fantastic way of putting it. Because the primary goal of any group is privilege. That's freedom is universal or it's not at all. You know, if everyone doesn't share the same amount of freedom, then what you have is a group that has privileges over others. You know, that's the main problem I have with collectivism, frankly.
And you're going to have a politics of groups jockeying over one another for freedom. For privilege.
For privilege, yeah.
Who has the more privilege?
But the thing is, there can be no real negotiation there, you know, because you're never going to persuade a group that has significant privileges to just give them up, because it's good to have a privilege. You know, you feel like you deserve it. You like having a privilege. You know, it's beneficial to you. You know, it's very difficult to persuade these people to give them up, so you have to come up with a very strong moral reason. For example, the abolitionists against slavery, it's a very strong moral argument, based on individualism, you know?
But what actually happens when people are on this group perspective is what you do is you get groups jockeying against each other.
Oh, absolutely.
And you get one group trying to challenge the privilege of another group. So you try to make a coalition of, you know, minorities and women and this and that to challenge the privilege of the white males, and then you get the cis and the gay, or you try to figure out what coalitions of people who see themselves, or you encourage to see themselves, primarily as part of this tribe or that tribe, you can get together to stack against the dominant tribe. And I think what you need to do to stop that and to get to a more principled kind of politics is to push people to think of themselves not primarily as white or black, gay or straight, cis or trans, of this ethnicity or that ethnicity, but think whatever those things are and however valuable they might be to you, and certainly your sexual identity and who you love is going to be really of value to you, but primarily you're a human being and you're an individual. And a human being, human beings are individuals. And what that comes down to is that we're people who determine our course of lives by our thinking. We have values. We have things that we want. And each of us is capable of forming values, coming to care about things and love things and think about what's good about them and how they can fit together into a life that's worth living. And that's something that each person does for himself, can only do for himself or herself. And if you're thinking of yourself as like that, you're thinking, I'm someone who's in this world who wants to make something of my life. No one else could do that for me. Just even if they try to, they can't do it for me because no one else can care about something the way I can care about it. Yeah. And in order to care about it, I have to dedicate myself to it. I have to go after it. I have to think about how other things coordinate and fit into it. If you think about that as what your life's about, you think of yourself as somebody who has reason, has the ability to choose, has the ability to make your life about something, has the ability to define what happiness is for you and to pursue it, then you're going to value individualism. Hmm. But there's something very egoistic about that.
And I was thinking about this myself because the big question of the beginning of the 21st century is identity. Who is what and why are you these things? What right do you have to claim to be these things, and what right do other people have to take this away from you? And you'll notice that the far left is pathologically obsessed with identity, and if you're a straight white man, they're pathologically obsessed about taking your identity away. They will do everything they can to try and destroy that, to try and take every kind of social support structure that you feel from the process of you being what you are away from you. And these are just like the sort of, if you think about them, this is like, if you think about yourself on top of a structure, and you're standing there, and this structure that is you, it's your ego, it's the person you consider yourself to be. This is built up by your accomplishments, by the things that you innately are, by the friends and relations you have, by the job you have, by where you live, the social groups you move in. All of these are pillars that create you as the individual. And there's an active force in society at the moment that is working a way to knock down those pillars. So you as an individual feel lost and alone and unable to challenge them. So one of the things that we have to do is really think about what makes us, like what makes me, me, what makes you, you, and you, you, you know, and why are we different? How are these things, like, how are these legitimized? You know, why do you feel self-confident and happy? You know, and why are there people who are trying to take that away from you? But I do think that the conception of a person as an individual is really important, because When the postmodernists, when the far left are sat there going, well, you're white, you're this, you're that, they're listing off characteristics. How much of this actually makes up your personality? You know, this is the thing that's happening with Kanye West at the moment, and I absolutely adore watching it happen. And I feel genuinely bad for him. And when he met President Trump the other day, and he was, you know, I put on my MAGA hat and I've this my Superman cape, because this is Kanye saying, you know, I'm not a black man. I'm not a straight man. I'm not, you know, I am Kanye West. I'm the individual that I have had an input into creating the individual that is Kanye West. And that's me. That's how I identify. I'm going to own that. And if it takes me saying I'm wearing a MAGA hat, you know, and you screw you all for your, you know, all of your like, oh, but black people must do this, you know, men must do this. No. He, you know, live your life as you want to live it. Then, I mean, like I said, I haven't got the answer here, but you know, that's what's happening with Kanye West at the moment. I'm not black, I'm Kanye, was an unironic article that I think was The Atlantic published. Mm-hmm. And it was like, there we are, that's the whole thing encapsulated in one headline. You know, there are prescriptive requirements to be black. And this is why Don Lemon is on TV calling him Trump's token Negro. I mean, the left this guy's a token Negro. You can't even imagine saying that, right? When would someone like Lindsey Graham say that? He would never even, it would never encountenance. But this is the worldview. They think that because they can identify groups, then there must be a universal experience for all of the people within that sort of vector. And the same with being male, female, black, white, you know, all this sort of thing. But it never actually encompasses the identity of the individual. It's always looking at it from the outside rather than projecting it towards the rest of the world.
If I'm not mistaken, that article, "I'm Not Black, I'm Kanye," was written by Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's really the kind of dominant intellectual of race studies these days, right?
Yeah.
But it's the end of a... That way of thinking, put Kanye himself aside for a moment, is the end of a kind of line that's been developed in thinking about race, in thinking about gender, in thinking about other fields that's really destructive. And what I'm worried that's happening now is that that way of thinking that's dominated the left is coming to take hold on the right, where now we think, well, we're white men. We see ourselves as a persecuted or aggrieved group, and we want to fight back in the same way. And it's something that's wrong if white men do it, but it's wrong when black men or gay women or whatever it is. And it's, if you look back at the civil rights movement in America, there's a really interesting history here. There were competing strands in the civil rights movement. There was always an individualist strand in the movement. Not always, but there was, and it was dominant in the early 60s, where you can think of Dr. King talking about being judged by the content of your character. You can think of it as a movement to take rights that all people should have and that all Americans have by the Constitution, or they're meant to be protected for all Americans by the Constitution, say, we haven't been protecting these for everyone, and really foregrounding that fact and pushing to protect them. And that was what the NAACP in America was about in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And it's something that really solidified in the American anti-racism movement after the end of World War II, when collectivism was really discredited in the American mindset for a long time. And we could see we're now in a war with Russia, in a Cold War with Russia. Because of that, there's less funding going to things that seem communistic, and more importantly, there's people who want to think about how to really solve problems are thinking around less communistic lines, around more individualistic lines. And this is something that's been noticed about the civil rights movements of that time by people on the left, as well as people who think this is a bad move, as well as people like me who think it's a good move, that for that period, it was focused primarily on individuals. On individuals have certain rights, and they've been denied to black people, and they shouldn't be. Yeah. But the other strand in the race, anti-racism movement, and it's really a pro-racism strand, although it's called anti-racism, is there's black people and white people, and we have black people have to band together and black power.
It's the grievance studies.
And it's now the grievance studies. Yeah.
You can either be immortalized like Martin Luther King, or you can get shot by Nation of Islam. Mm. They're your options, really, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, now even the Nation of Islam was complex because there was a fair amount of self-help stuff in Malcolm X. And in fairness, there's a fair amount of self-help stuff in Ta-Nehisi Coates, too. But the main message that's coming across is not self-help, but help your tribe, revenge. Yeah. We're one against the whites who are oppressing us. And you see that in all of these leftist causes reinvigorated in the late 60s. You see it in the 30s and 40s when everything's dominated by Marxism. And you see it really reinvigorated on campuses now. And also Islamism is a version of this.
Oh, yes.
So you might have thought, if you read, there's a wonderful book by Majid Nawaz, Radical, where he talks about his becoming a member of an Islamist group and then coming out of it. And a big part of it was things that he... learning to understand some problems he had, racism, things that he encountered, persecution, as, well, this is because I'm a Muslim, and the Muslims are put upon, and the solution is for Muslims to all band together, regardless of their other differences, and start a caliphate. Right? And it's the same kind of thing. You notice real problems there are in the world, but you interpret them through an ideology of collectives in eternal struggle with each other.
Absolutely. It's group dynamics. Yeah. It's nothing but group dynamics.
And then you double down on whatever group you're in.
Exactly. And if your group isn't winning, then you're the victims. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you're living a fantastic life, you know, and this is the grievance mongers are the worst for this, because if you look at them, their material conditions are amazing. You know, these are university students. They're doing fantastic for themselves. They're healthy, they're wealthy, they're living longer than ever, they're freer than ever, they've got access to more technology, more information. Things could not be better, and yet they're sat there screaming that they're oppressed because they see themselves as part of a group that isn't being dominating, that isn't dominating over society. And that's
the other side of it, though. If you want to think about the best people who get taken in by this,
right?
The other side of it is that there are injustices, there are real problems, there are people who aren't doing well in ways that are unfair, and the right analysis of that isn't in terms of group dynamics and groups that have to gang up on one another. And so those of us who are individualists should be thinking about, well, what is the right analysis of it?
Yes.
What is the right way to understand it? What is a productive way to encourage somebody who's concerned about the injustices that women face, the injustices that gays face, the plight of people who are transgender, whatever the issue is, what is a constructive individualist way to deal with that rather than ganging up?
See, now that's a very good point. And I love the way you formulate that, because it gives me a great launch point. I don't agree there are problems that women face.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There are problems that individuals face. Some of these are women, and sometimes it's disproportionately individuals who are women that face these. But these are, I mean, you can't find a law in a Western country that's specifically designed to target and oppress women. You know, that you're not going to find something like that. And so it's a lazy characterization of the left for them to go, well, this is a women's issue. It's like, well, why are there 52% of women who are opposing you on this? Mm-hmm. You know, if this is a women's issue, it's obviously not. It's an ideological issue. You know, the abortion issue in America, for example. You know, the conservative women are anti-abortion. They think abortion is a moral wrong, and they don't want to see it propagated throughout their society. So when the feminists scream, you know, abortion rights are women's rights, it's like, well, I don't even know if they are. You know, if more women than not oppose, and not just are indifferent, but actively oppose what you consider to be the right to abort a child, a baby, then, you know, we need to have a really serious conversation about that.
For any right that's a legitimate right, more people than not who have that right don't recognize it as a right. It's a right not to live under a dictatorship or under, you know, a king who's really empowered as a king rather than a figurehead. And yet almost everybody in human history didn't realize they had that right. And it's a right, in my view, not to have your money taxed away and redistributed to other people. But hardly anybody who has that right recognizes it as a right. But for whatever you think is a right, a majority of people in history probably didn't.
Well, that's true, but I mean, this is another thing that when we go back hundreds of years, we've got to think about the practical physical circumstances of the people living. You know, I mean, often it was, you know, nasty, brutish, and short. So it's easy from a position of privilege in a first world country to say, well, you know, these people just didn't realize how oppressed they were. But, you know, I think that there, but for the grace of God, if you were in their position, you'd probably have a very similar viewpoint. But
I agree. So
yeah, of course.
It's not that I'm brilliant, and I see all
I wasn't trying to imply that. But getting back to the characterization of women's issues, mm-hmm. I'm not even sure these are necessarily women's issues, because most women don't seem to have a problem with half of the stuff that feminists are talking about. It's not that it's a women's issue, it's a feminist issue. And I think we should, instead of identifying the category they want to pander to, we should identify the ideology that's pushing the agenda. For example, we could say healthcare is a socialist issue, mm-hmm. Rather than a poor issue.
Yeah, but don't take it as the issue. Don't take it as the political issue. Take it as the facts on the ground that might make a reasonable person start to see it the way that the feminists see it, or the socialists see it, or whatever it is. So there are, for example, I've learned over the past few years, and I think a lot of us have learned over the past few years, that a lot more people, especially women, but other people too, are sexually harassed in pretty significant ways in the workforce. I thought for some time that this was happening and it was bad. As a result of the Me Too movement, just a lot more of it there seems to be than I thought. And case after case would come out where the first allegation would come out against a guy and I'd say, that probably didn't happen, or it was misunderstood, or he didn't really mean to grab her that way. They were posing for a picture, his hand just slipped. But then, you know, 30 women come out and accuse him of the same thing. And you think, what? I wasn't aware that a lot of celebrities posing with women for pictures were grabbing them in inappropriate ways, and it turns out that. So,
well, if I don't address this, I'll get castigated.
Okay.
The thing with the Me Too movement is initially it was necessary. I mean, the Harvey Weinsteins of the world, the toxic culture in Hollywood. I mean, the more I learn about Hollywood, the more I think this is a vile entity that I can't believe any. I mean, you get it's, you know, the glitz and glamour of it, the facade of it is so impressive. It draws in people who are just, they're young, they're on their own, they're poor, and there are people who are just slightly up the ladder who say, I can bring you up. And it's such a temptation, and it's such an easy position of power to abuse that undoubtedly Me Too is definitely necessary in Hollywood. But now you see it expanding into realms where it's probably not necessary. You know? And now, we have seen many, and I will say absolutely cynical, attempts at ruining people based on the perception that, well, if 30 women or, you know, 5 women or whatever are, you know, claiming some guy did something, I'm going to point to this guy and say it's him, then it must be true. Even though if you look in the individual circumstances of the allegations, they might have absolutely nothing to them, or you look at the person themselves and you find it's someone like Stephanie Guthrie, who's a Canadian feminist activist who had a sort of brief tryst with, I think it was, who was the famous atheist guy? Who was on Fox News, you know, tide goes in, tide goes out. Who's the atheist? I can't remember his name. Yeah, but that was Bill O'Reilly. But the atheist he was talking about, he got a slew of Me Too allegations. And then when you read into them, you realize that these are actually, what I mean, like, one of the description of the attack was, she was married, and him and her got together at a conference. They had a bit of a fool around, and then she decided she wanted to leave, and so she left. That's not wrong. You know, he didn't do anything, and yet now she's bringing Me Too allegations against him. There are definitely cynical actors.
We're definitely in a climate where cynical actors, whatever ones there are empowered.
But I don't want to make it sound like there's no genuine problem.
Let's just take two cases that surprise. These are two cases, both of people I antecedently didn't like, but where I thought, this allegation, I don't really buy it.
Yeah.
And then enough other people had similar stories about the person that I started to think, yeah, I think this is probably true. So Al Franken was a Saturday Night Live comedian in America and then a senator, far left. People thought of him as a possible presidential candidate right next time around. And George Bush, the first president. Both of them, it seems, were groping women who were taking pictures with them.
That's true,
in inappropriate ways. And my sense is, who the hell would do that? Why would you do that? And why would you think you'd get away? Both of these guys seems like they were doing it and getting away with it for a really long time.
There was one with George H.W. Bush where he's 90 now or something and in a wheelchair. And recently it came out that, you know, someone had the pick stick and he hand up.
Yes.
And it's
and
like,
so I thought, okay, so he's senile.
There are definitely problems.
It turns out he was doing it earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so it turns out there's a bunch of stuff that I was unaware was going on. If you're aware of cases of this kind of stuff going on, when I wasn't, right? And you're aware that most people or most men aren't aware of it, or a lot of people minimize it, or aren't aware of the extent of it, or whatever. Now you're someone who thinks this is a problem, right? The only people in the political culture who are saying it's a problem and claim to have a solution for it and claim to have a way of thinking about why it's a problem are the feminists.
Yeah.
And so that might attract you to feminism. And if feminism and the feminist movement as it exists now is not the right solution, and if what their causes are aren't the right causes, well, then those of us who don't see ourselves as part of it need to do a better job of saying, well, what is the right way to think about these kinds of injustices? And likewise for a million other little injustices that give plausibility to, and some big injustices, that give plausibility to each of the kinds of movements that the grievance studies department gravitate around.
Now, that's a great...
Do you mind if I make this one point?
Just very quickly. You make a great point. And this is getting back to the mud of politics. So I appreciate the objectivist position is not going to be in favor of what I'm suggesting. But from a pragmatic position, this is what drives me crazy about Republicans in America. They, like you say, they don't have a solution on healthcare, and they're not willing to compromise ideologically. And this is leaving a demographic underserved, that they can't go to the right and say, Republicans, solve this problem for me, because the Republicans, and it's not even that they don't necessarily have solutions, they just don't articulate these solutions in a way that these people understand. So at the end of the day, the problems are real, and you can pretend they don't matter all you want, but while you're busy pretending a certain problem doesn't matter and getting on with your agenda in other respects, more and more people will find themselves in that problem grows bigger and bigger. And this is honestly why the progressives have found themselves in the age of the internet, where we should have the most free access to information possible, that there is an active and very well-motivated free speech movement all across the internet and all across the Western world at the moment. You shouldn't think that sort of thing should exist in this kind of environment, but it does, because of reasons you stated.
All right, we have about 40 minutes for questions. If you raise your hand, Red will bring
up. Hey, you raised the Me Too movement there, and specifically in relation to Hollywood. I think something that I don't hear very often in terms of a point is when you said there about women, being poor, being people taking advantage of them.
Yeah.
Are you not discounting the freedom of individual women to maybe use their own sexual power to get what they want? And
nope.
Aren't you infantilizing women by saying that we have to prevent people being...
That was my point exactly when I started first looking into this and talking to people about it, and I got castigated for saying how can you say that there are women who knowingly understand that they're attractive and are aware that they can get paid by moving up the ladder in this way? That's why it exists, Most of that's why when you see like Harvey Weinstein, the funniest thing about Harvey Weinstein is it's only a handful of the women that have come into professional contact with Harvey Weinstein that are alleging things. I mean, you see the pictures of him manhandling Emma Watson at various things, and you think, where's her allegation against him? Do we believe that he didn't do something? Bollocks.
Well, there were women that actually came, like Carrie Fisher, didn't she say she fucked George Lucas for the part?
And... Did she? I didn't know that.
She did, yeah.
But exactly, the sort of the women who are also around Harvey Weinstein who aren't making allegations, I think they're the women who knew what they were doing and thought, I'm going to get on with it. It's a sacrifice I'm willing to make, and they made out with it. It's okay.
And it's the free market then.
I'm not against that at all, but the problem that you have is it does breed this kind of atmosphere where people who aren't interested in doing that and are being pressured into it. So,
But another issue is, it might be, and I think that the way to think about this isn't a patriarchy that's oppressing women, right? That's the way the feminist movement portrays it. But a culture that has a very unhealthy attitude towards sex, that has an unhealthy attitude towards gender differences and towards women and men, and that sees it as something kind of... has all kinds of double standards around what we can say in public versus what we're going to do in private. And this is a situation that's bad for everybody, and in some cases... the harms of it fall especially badly on women, or certain women. But people of both genders are to blame for it, and the question is, how do we identify and fix that problem, rather than how do we smash the patriarchy, or preserve it, for that matter?
Hello. My question is Carl. So earlier in the discussion, you said about how you believed that people won't change their minds in believing that altruism is what is good. It seems like when the question of ethics has always come up, you seem to... I believe you've dodged the question a bit. Do you care about, say, putting forward a secular reason for altruism, or do you just want to describe instead of prescribe?
I mean, it'd be a lot easier for me to just describe. That was just an observation. You know, I genuinely don't think you're going to be able to persuade people that the objectivist form of ethics is something that they will recognize as morally good. I don't think most people will recognize that. How do you want to go into this?
I was just wondering whether or not care about tackling it, or...
Well, I mean, I see it as kind of a lost cause, to be honest. You know, there are certain things that you can undoubtedly do a huge amount of work on, but I think that it's going to go over the heads of most people, because, again, another one of these sort of politically realist points that I have to bring up is that most people aren't that smart. You know, I'm not denigrating anyone. Just look at the data. You know, most people are below average. So, and if you've got socialists who come along with very simple points, very simple, and points that already fit into their moral framework, they become far more effective, and they become like Jeremy Corbyn. So I'm going to dodge that question again, sorry.
Well, personally, when I've been talking to people, it's usually those that are less educated that I get through, never mind. It's been the other way around for
me. If we're okay to discuss this, so the reason I'm not an objectivist is, I guess, probably because I don't understand objectivism well enough. I'm not joking. But the way that it seems, looking from the outside in, is that there is a moral good in serving yourself. And I believe that moral good comes from choice. And I believe that serving yourself is not a choice. You don't have a choice but to serve yourself. And everything you do, everyone is self-serving all the time. And that's not wrong. It's not right or wrong. It's natural. You know, you are a particular entity. No one else is going to serve you for you, or at least until we become socialists. Then, you have to do this for yourself. And that's normal. And so this is the reason why people think, well, okay, if you're doing something for someone else and not yourself, we can identify that categorically as a moral action, as an altruistic action. And that is what they would consider to be moral, because you're not just doing something that you personally benefit from. I'm happy for the objectivist now to rip me apart. So please be my guest.
So let me start by saying objectivism is a radical philosophy. And moral views do sometimes change. And other views do sometimes change in populations over time.
It's not that moral views don't change. It's that the structure broadly remains the same. Like going back to Christianity, the structure has been the same for 2,000 years, effectively. And the way it's been worked within the structure is...
If you think about... I do want to talk specifically about egoism, but just first, if you think about it, I mean, it used to be just assumed that there are natural classes of people that some are superior to others and have more rights than others. Everyone assumed that from ancient Greece until the abolitionist movement, basically, or until the early Enlightenment, but it didn't get widespread rejected until the abolitionist movement, right? And now everyone assumes the opposite. So there's possibility for change in deeply held moral views, but it takes a long time, and one has to be what I call a patient radical about it, and think about how one can advance it slowly. But let me address the specific point that you made about.
Sorry.
I don't think everybody always acts in their self-interest. Most people spend a lot of their time destroying themselves, or at least not doing things that are good for them. So they might be doing things that they want, but we have an idea of self-interest as opposed to the idea of what you want now, right? Precisely to make that distinction. I know it's not good for me, but I want it. Okay, well, so then you have to decide, which are you going to do?
But it depends. Again, it depends how you're defining what's good for you, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to take an objective view and say, okay, scientifically, this is bad for your body, mm-hmm. for me to smoke, mm-hmm. scientifically might be bad, but psychologically, it might be really good for me.
So it
because
might
I might be under a huge amount of pressure, and I might think, right, I'm going to go outside, have a cigarette, and it's a way of relieving stress. So it does still have a physiological benefit.
So before we settle what is really good for you, right? But notice that you can have the idea, I want this and it's not good for me. He wants that, but it's not good for him.
Yeah.
And you can raise the point, and you can do it in your own mind. Well, smoking is bad for me, but I still want to do it. Well, do I just mean it's bad for my body, but it's good for me in other ways, and that outweighs the bad for my body, or am I just kidding myself when I say that, right? You can have that thought process. And it's not just about what's bad for your body. Like, is staying in this relationship good for me?
Yeah.
It's comfortable to stay in this relationship, but parts of me aren't. There's a real question you could have about whether what you want to do is good for you. So it's possible to have an idea of, and I think we do have an idea of, but it's vague and fuzzy for most of us, right? What's good for me on whole, or what my interest is on whole, that's distinct from what I want, so that it's a question of whether what I want is the same thing as is good for me.
I'm not sure you can distinguish what someone's passions from their interests. You know, I'm not sure you can distinguish that. For example, like, you name something, and I can tell you how it benefits you. I don't believe an individual is actually really capable of doing something that is genuinely not in their self-interest and not in the interest of someone else, because it will seem irrational.
Question is, if you have a... I wanted to get back to choice over there.
Yeah.
But the question, if you have an idea of self-interest, right, one of the things that it encompasses is that there are all sorts of different things that might be good for you or bad for you, or good or bad for you now, but there's some need to kind of sum them up and say, you know, there are always trade-offs, right?
Of course.
And so if I factor everything in that's relevant, is this thing best for me? Or is it one of these things that although there's something to be said for it, like it feels nice, when I factor everything in, it's on whole not best for me. So if you have the idea that it's sort of a question about whether what someone's motivated to do in a moment is really what's on whole best for them. And there's a question about how we even figure out what's on whole best for someone, and whether there's some list of things that are what's on whole best for everyone, or whether each person has to form it for themselves. But as soon as you can draw that distinction between what you're motivated to do in a moment and what's on whole, everything considered rationally best for you, then there's at least intelligibility to the question of which should you do, and how can you figure out which one's which. And as for choice, I agree. Morality is about choice.
Just to get to that point, I mean, I agree with you with the way you're characterizing that. But at the end of the day, all of that is still about your own self-interest. You can't get away from that. I'm not sure that humans can get away from that.
Well, so if what we mean by self-interest is the thing that's on whole best for us, on whole best for me, all things considered, as opposed to what I might be motivated to do in this moment, which may or may not be what's on whole best for me.
I don't think that's how we should define it. That's not how I would define it. I think a person's interests are obviously particular to them. I think they are often a combination of what would be best in the long run and what would be immediately gratifying. And I don't think there's any particular distinction other than the decision the person makes in the moment. So, I mean, even if I say, right, okay, I'm gonna stop smoking because it'll be good for me in the long run, that's still my own self-interest, you know. And I'm just making a calculated decision about how stressed I feel right now and how much I desire a cigarette, and you know whether I think it's gonna have a long-term effect.
So there's a philosophical view that you could hold that what determines what your interest is. There is nothing to your interest.
Well, everything's ideological.
Over and above what the sum of things you choose in different moments.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, that's all ideological, though, isn't it? That's
I'm not sure what you're saying. It's all
ideological. Well, that's like how your worldview is.
Right. So one view of human nature is such that there's all that it is for something to be good for someone, given that there are all these other factors, is that it's the thing he chooses in the moment. It's just revealed preferences, as the economist would say. Right. But that view is not obviously right, and it's not necessarily right, and I in fact think it's wrong. So some sets of things that you can, first of all, we don't just choose in moments, right? We choose over time.
Sure.
And what's important and interesting about us, nothing that's really worth having is something you can choose in a moment and achieve in that same moment, or very little of it is.
Yeah, I agree.
A couple of things maybe, but you know, but it's what you set as a goal over time and you achieve over time. And if you're trying, and what's consonant with what you're achieving over time, and if you're trying to achieve a bunch of things over time, you have an issue of how you coordinate your action for it over time, how you tie those things together into plans for your life, how you live your days such that you can be advancing these projects you have, and so forth. And if that's right, not every set of things that you might pick to go after are going to cohere into a whole that works together. And not every choice you make in a moment is going to fit with the longer-term things you're going after. So what I think morality does, or what Rand's morality is meant to do,
right,
is to give you the principles to come up with the kind of life for yourself, and call this your self-interest, which is a sustainable thing that you can pursue over time, where all the parts of it are going to contribute to the other parts, like the parts of an artwork kind of cohere together and all make it work, rather than clashing and everything frustrates the other. As opposed to the way most of us live most of the time, which is we go after this now, we go after this, they don't fit together, achieving one of your goals frustrates one of your other goals. So if that distinction is possible, if that distinction is real, then there's a role for an idea of self-interest that can serve as a norm guiding you what to do. And there's a role for philosophical principles telling you how to come up with and pursue an interest like that for yourself. And that's what I see Rand's ethics as aimed at doing.
I agree that there definitely can be this. You definitely can define that in that way. That's not illegitimate, in my opinion. Although, I mean, the problem I have, though, is, I mean, how do you justify doing any kind of charity? Like, where does the love for one's fellow man come into it? Because at the end of the day, people really do like each other.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it may seem like on the internet everyone hates each other, but they genuinely don't. You know, they just don't know each other. As soon as you put people in a room, you get them talking, then they start feeling bonds. And I'm probably misinterpreting what objectivists I know personally have said to me about this, because, like I said, I'm not a great scholar on Rand or anything. But I mean, how do you come to the impulse to want to help someone else?
Well, before the impulse, let me say something more general, and then I'll come to that.
Sure.
But so there are many things that are of value to each of us, right? And reasonably and rationally of value, but just start with that we just like, we find ourselves in liking, right? We'll talk about why it's worth liking them. Other people are one of them, along with food and drink and smoking and working and doing certain things, and you have to decide which ones are good for you in what proportion, right? So helping specific other people and helping other people in general is something that most of us want. And what it is to pursue that egoistically is to pursue it in a way where our lives, our own goals aren't subservient to other people, but rather helping the other people who are valuable to us is one of the things that goes into the mix of the project that is our self-interest. And then you want to think about, well, if there are principles that determine what things can go into that mix and how they can go into that mix, and what of the things we desire is it really reasonable for us to desire, why is it reasonable to desire helping other people and doing well for them? And there are, I think, several reasons for that. First of all, even in the putting aside personal relationships for a moment, there's a tremendous amount you get from living with other people. You learn a ton from them. You're able to trade with them. There's all the kinds of values you can get from that. Then add in there's the inspiration you can get from them. Seeing other people leading their lives successfully gives you a model for what you can want out of life, for what you can achieve out of life. It's tremendous spiritual. It's the kind of thing you get from art, seeing other people lead their lives. Then there's love relationships and friendships and all that that can bring to your life. And so once you bring those things, then it's pretty easy to see why you'd be motivated to help friends, to have friends, to help people around you, why you'd want to have a society in which other people are doing well so that you can learn from them and flourish. And then if you're someone who's living this way, and if you believe, and this is another premise that I'd need to argue for, but if you believe that there aren't conflicts of interests among people when they are living this way, that your doing well helps me and my doing well helps you, so that we're not going to be at loggerheads, then there's no reason not to wish other people well, and a lot of reason to wish them well. And that gives an impetus and a grounding for valuing other people doing well and wanting to help them succeed and being willing to do things to help them succeed. And then the question is, where does that fit within the hierarchy of your other values? So that your life isn't all about that, but there is a place for it, and you have to think about what place.
So, yeah, okay. So no, that's perfectly cogent, and I don't have any particular objection to what you're saying there. I think most people don't live their lives in such terms of pure reason. I think that's honestly beyond most people. You know, if we remember that half of society is below average, you've got to accept that's the reality of the world. So, you know, I don't disagree that, you know, wanting to help someone else succeed can be a part of your own success. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think that generally that's true. But it's trying to explain to someone who doesn't have an IQ of 130 that, you know, because, I mean, I've found a lot of objectivists are very smart people, you know, and they think these things through to the maximum extent. And, you know, a lot of the time it's difficult to pick it apart, but most people are not like that. And so most people, for when you say, you know, it's in my rational self-interest to do these things because then the world around me becomes better, most people operate much more on gut, I think. And I don't know if you can explain it to them in a way that they're going to understand.
So if people operate on gut, if the question of where the contents of their gut comes from...
Oh, I totally agree. You know?
And the content of their guts comes from the kind of ideas they've absorbed and the kind of culture they've absorbed growing up. So if someone really can't think these things through at any level, they're probably going to act in the way that it's in their culture to act. And if you had a culture dominated by objectivism, they'd learn those habits of action that are consistent with it. But let me just add,
okay.
I think there are simpler and more complicated ways to get points. Yeah. So you're one of these smart people, and you're asking these questions in a kind of in a kind of complicated way about the nature of self-interest and something. But if somebody was saying, you know, why should I give a crap if this guy drowns or lives, right? There's a simply, he's a person like you, and look at this thing he made, and isn't that great? And think of all your friends. He could be one of them. There are kind of simple-minded ways to make
the same
point.
Okay, that's a great way of framing, actually. There's a guy out there drowning. He's a person like you.
Mm-hmm.
You might have some sort of benefit from him, but there's a distinct risk that I'm going to drown if I go out there and try and save him. Mm-hmm. Where's the moral motivation for me to do it?
But that's just the issue. So I don't think it depends on how big the risk is, right? What we want to we want to get on the page, yeah, right, to think about why would there be any motivation in objectivism to help other people is why would we prefer the guy not drown? Now, once we see that we would prefer the guy not to drown, right, we're willing to lift a finger to help him drown, then it's a question how many fingers to lift, so to speak, how much risk to go in for it. And there are things that some people think they're obligated to do or a right to do. That's too much. I don't think you should, in general, risk your life to help strangers.
Oh, no. There are cases where maybe you should. These are, you know, subjective moral values that are determined from person to person, and you contextualize them. How deep is the water? How quickly is the river raging? You know,
how good a swimmer are you?
Exactly, how good a swimmer are you? You've got to take all of these things into account, obviously. But I mean,
but your original question is why should I care about other people, not why. So I'm saying why you should. Now there's what should you do about it, given that you care?
Well,
and then we got to bring in all the details.
Let's go back
to
that. I mean, why do I care if that guy drowns?
Because he's a person. People are good. In general, people contribute to your life. Having more people around is good. People are wonderful things.
But I think that the Christian ethic on the other side of that would say, well, If let's say we're talking about people as objectivists, mm-hmm, I'm not sure they would recognize objectivism as good.
Guys, yeah. Sorry.
Sorry, we're going off. We can talk later. Sorry.
All right, let's. People are a value, so let's get some of these.
Yes,
in.
Yes, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
Hi there. You just brought it onto morality.
That's a very interesting question. I think the important thing to do is remember that the left isn't a monolith, although it looks like one because it acts like one, but it's actually not. It's a bunch of people who are, in their rational self-interest, accepting that they're part of a team, and the team effort has become, and it really is down to a conflict of worldviews. You know, the conflict is, and it genuinely is the group more important than the individual? And it's easy to say that, but what I mean by that is they have, like when Ben Shapiro went on Bill Maher, And he was like, you're an always Trumper. And Ben Shapiro was like, no, I'm not, you know. But Bill Maher was like, well, I'm a Democrat, which, you know, this is a never Trumper, you know. And that's, he was defining themselves that way. And so once you've got this, now the moral good becomes the team. You know, that's the question. How is our team going to win? And so when you've adopted that as a worldview, you realize, right, okay, now anything's up for grabs. I've already defined myself as moral because I'm part of this team. The team is the moral objective. The victory of the team is the goal. I can do it, you know, it doesn't really matter how I get there. You know, the ends will justify the means. It's not that the left don't have morals. It's that the people who are conducting the course of the activism are deliberately compromising what they would otherwise agree in other circumstances would be immoral actions and whatnot. They're deliberately doing this because they think there is an objective they can reach, and the sacrifices morally that they have to make are acceptable. It doesn't matter if Brett Kavanaugh gets his reputation destroyed, despite the fact that throughout his entire professional career, you can't find a single woman who will actually allege that he's done anything to them. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, none of that matters, because at the end of the day, they want people to overwhelmingly believe women because they think there'll be a much greater moral gain if we just blanket believe women and, you know, the poor guys who are getting, you know, sapped by, you know, cynical actors, they don't really matter. They're a small portion of the whole. But that's the difference. We believe that the individual, you know, I would rather 10 guilty men go free than one innocent man go to prison. And they genuinely believe the opposite. I mean, they will, and you've probably seen the graphics going around on social media, the rapes. Well, only 2% of accusations of rape are false. And so mostly it's not illegitimate. It's like, well, okay, but you're imagining you're not one of those 2% of guys. You know, are you prepared to go to jail because, you know, there are some rapists who go free? Is that, that's because that's the question they never answer. So no, it's not that they don't have morals. It's just that they're desperate, frankly. I think they've realized that political correctness isn't very popular. They've realized socialism isn't very popular. And they are on a downward spiral, and I think they're clawing desperately to anything that they can hold on to. And this is where the sort of the raw expression of power, you know, demands for power is coming from. Because when people don't feel like they're about to lose everything, then they start sort of self-actualizing and thinking more in moral terms. But now I think they're going into a pit, and they know it, I think, subconsciously at least.
Let me just add, I don't think this is a phenomenon that's distinctive to the left. Both political sides, at least in the States, I haven't been following politics here, I think are basically functioning tribally. And I think they're basically seeing themselves as a group with an interest, and whatever will hurt the other side is what's good. And they're defining themselves primarily in opposition to the other side. So if you look at the American right now, don't think the people who think of themselves as right all have much in common except hating the left.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at the left, maybe that's a little more in common, but a lot of it is hating the right. How can you not be for Trump? The left is going to kill us. Well, but how could you be against Trump? The right is going to... not against Trump. The right is going to kill us. As opposed to thinking about what are the issues, what's true and what's good, and how does that apply in this issue? And I think there's... Our whole political discussion has gotten much too about tribes and teams and not enough about let's think about the facts of this case. Let's think about what the principles are here. And it's something I think it's easy to get sucked into, whether you think of yourself as part of the right or part of the left or neither. It's easy to get sucked into, ooh, this monolith of awful people I'm fighting against.
It's gratifying.
And, yeah, and it is. You feel like it's like being on a sports
team
or something.
Yeah.
So you need to, in yourself, really make an effort to say, well, what's true here? How can I tell? Why do I think this? Am I being swayed by the mob and so forth? And then to encourage that in other people. And it takes work.
Yeah, but it's not the left don't have morality. It's that they have collective morality. It's herd morality. You know, it's what's good for the group and the individual. It's good for a few individuals to be picked off by the lions. You know.
Hiya. So to Sargon, I really like your kind of liberalist label. I like the liberalist principles that you came up with.
Yeah.
But one of those labels was a commitment to blind justice and kind of the equality of all people, regardless of race and religion. Bearing that in mind, do you support UKIP's new policy of Muslim-only prisons?
That's a misrepresentation of the policy. It's not Muslim-only prisons. The problem that we have in British prisons at the moment is that people aren't all the same. And so when you put groups of people in prison, they become very tribal for their own self-protection because prison's a dangerous place. And then you have... The way that these groups are formed are through identity. And so if you have an identity of Muslim, then Muslims will tend to band together. Perfectly natural, utterly normal. You wouldn't even be able to prevent it. However, in the identity of Muslim are a subset of people who really believe in the identity of Muslim. And we could call them Muslim supremacists, otherwise known as Islamists. And these people tend to want to radicalize along the most hardline interpretation of a certain set of principles and beliefs and scriptures from the canon of Islam. And these are radicalizing other prisoners. And so you have to separate these kind of Islamic radicals in the same way that if you had a very multiracial prison, I would want the white supremacists separated from just the regular white people. You know, I wouldn't want to radicalize Nazis in prison in the same way. And I think that these kind of ideological radicals do have to be separated and kept away from people who they would... And this is something that the US encountered in massive problems in Afghanistan and Iraq, where they didn't understand any of this. And so they were just putting Muslims all in a big camp. And so you had al-Baghdadi in, like, 2006. He was effectively the camp commandant. He would be standing in front of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of inmates who would be salaaming and he would be reciting. And you've got to separate that because they're going to cause more problems than otherwise left alone.
Earlier you said the goal of individual is freedom. So can you define the word freedom for me? Because if you are ultimately free, you're living outside the walled city, you live in the woods, that's the ultimate freedom, right? But when you're living in a city or in a family or in a village or in a state, you get a certain sense of responsibilities, set of responsibilities. I mean, service guarantees citizenship, right?
Oh, yeah.
So where does freedom come into that?
Well, you can be free to choose your own duties, can't you? You know, you're not... The question, the point of freedom isn't to say I'm going to do nothing for anyone ever and I'm going to live like a loner in the woods all on my own because then, you know, I can do whatever I like. The question is, how, are you free to associate? Are you free to speak? Are you free to act in the way that you think would be morally permissible within the laws of the land? That's how I would define freedom. I don't think it just means being alone, you know, off in the woods. But you're the philosophy professor, so...
I also wouldn't say... I know... Carl said this, summing up something I said, but I wouldn't say that the goal of the individual is freedom. I'd say it's a goal. But the goal of an individual is, or I think should be, to lead his own life. And I think that means, or put it another way, to pursue his own happiness, as it's put in the Declaration of Independence in the States. That's what I think the goal of the individual should be. And I think freedom is something that we need in order to do that.
It's the mechanism.
It's a mechanism. Yes, it's the social condition that if you're an individual in a society, if you're not in a society, if you're off in the woods, you're not free or unfree. The issue just doesn't come up. But when you're living among other people, there's a way in which your society can be structured that leaves you able to lead your own life independently in pursuit of your happiness. So I would define freedom as the condition in which a human being's ability to lead his life independently, supporting his life by his own judgment and achieving his own goals, is secure from the interference by other people. And what that means is a state in which the person's rights to do that are defined and recognized by the government, and the government protects him so that other people can't, for example, impose on his freedom of speech by rioting or charging into his events or steal his money or any of the other things that people can do that can stop us from leading our lives independently. So the goal is to lead your own life, to pursue your own happiness. Freedom is the condition in which you're able to do that.
I mean, I would even contest the idea that someone living alone in the woods is even free. I mean, is that person free to pursue their own course of happiness, or are they constantly, every day, under a remarkable amount of pressure to just continue their own existence? You know, they have to go and hunt food, they have to chop wood, they have to do all the necessary things. I mean, there was an experiment in the 70s where It was something like 5 or 6 people in Britain went and lived off in like in the woods somewhere, and they lived with Iron Age technology. And the reports of their existence, they did this for like a year or something like that, and the reports of the existence that they had was remarkably oppressive. Like, one of the things that the socialists have worked out is that, oh, well, before capitalism, people only worked for 3 months of the year on the fields. It's like, you idiots, you know? Like, no, they spent 3 months a year sowing a field and reaping and bundling and doing whatever. But every day from dawn till dusk, you were working on something. You were knitting something. You were darning. You were doing something. You were churning butter. I mean, like, who here knows how butter's made? Do you know the raw amount of physical labor to produce a block of butter and cheese? You know, the idea that people living in more primitive societies than ours were, you know, they might not have had like direct government control or something like that. But I don't know if you can call that freedom, because just living in a primitive society is a difficult thing. It's not easy. Well, I don't know if, like, the when you're living alone in the woods, you do not get to determine your own decisions. Your decisions are forced on you by nature. You need to eat, you need to sleep, you need to keep dry, you need to keep warm. You have to do things in order to do this. That's not freedom. That's you being compelled by your circumstances. So the question is, that, like, when we get to a nice bourgeois society like this, we actually can countenance the idea of freedom as in, I'm actually not under any danger of starving or, you know, exposure or anything like that. So now I actually get to enjoy the idea of, what do I want? You know, and that's something that prior to sort of, you know, in human history has not generally been on people's minds.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I wouldn't agree that it's exactly what you're lacking in that situation is freedom in the political sense of it. But you don't have a leisurely, idyllic life.
Yeah.
And you face this challenge that we all face of how to make a living for yourself. And, you know, there's some, you might figure out a better way to do it, a better way to churn butter than the next guy or whatever, but it's a very labor-intensive, arduous life. What I think freedom is, though, is, at least in the political sense of the word freedom, there are other senses of the word, is it's having your ability to chart your course through life, secure from interference by other people. Because there's a particular evil and a particular hardship that comes from, you've churned the butter and now I take it, right? Or I make you churn the butter for me, right? And this is a kind of evil under which we've all had to live in different ways. Some people have been slaves, other people have had things just been mugged or whatever. But different ways people impose upon your life. And freedom is the state in which you're secure from that. And I think that's in which you're living among people, but secure from them using you in that way. And so that's what I understand freedom to be. And does it come with responsibilities? Only the responsibility to leave others secure from you. That is, not to impose upon them.
I think one last thing is, I don't think we should ever think we're going to achieve any kind of idea of perfect freedom. You know, there's one thing having an ideal, and there's another thing being trapped in a fleshy, imperfect human body. So, you know, the ideal may well exist conceptually, but, and this is, again, another problem the socialists have. They think that they can live up to an ideal. Don't be silly. Don't be silly. You know, just try and be better than you were yesterday. But sorry, I'll let someone else.
So this is with regards to something Scott Adams is about, especially with Trump, watching the same film on two different movie sets, people having different interpretations of it. I think we saw that again with the whole Brett Kavanaugh Senate issue. Yeah. So listening to Stefan Molyneux, all his podcasts recently on it, it seems that at the very best there was no credible evidence, and at worst it was a political hit job. So I've got this, you know, this objective truth, and then I listened to Sam Harris's latest podcast, and Sam's absolutely adamant that she's got nothing to gain whatsoever by going up and, you know, being in front of the Senate. So as well, he's being objective and he's being rational. So what would you do when this absolute differing worldviews of intelligent, smart people, and even Jordan Peterson placated neither side, because he thought he should go forward and then resign.
Okay, so you don't have an objective worldview with Stefan Molyneux's conception. Even though I agree with Stefan Molyneux's conception, he's making a bunch of assumptions there, and a lot of them are ideological. But again, I agree with them. You know, I think the result that we'll have by following these ideological assumptions is the best result. And the result that secures the personal liberty and the and creates justice most securely, which is presuming the innocence of the person accused because of the complete lack of evidence. Sam Harris is wrong by saying that she didn't have anything to gain. She clearly had things to gain. There was clearly, I mean, you probably all saw the photo of when she sat there on the thing and you've got people like leaning on her and pressure. Like there was clearly pressure on her. There was clearly a kind of, and who was the member of the DNC who had sat on this for a month?
Feinstein?
Feinstein, that was it, yeah. You know, so yeah, it was you know, clearly orchestrated. There was clearly backroom dealing there. You know, suddenly multiple GoFundMes are set up. She's got $1 million coming in. Sam Harris is just wrong. She absolutely had things to gain, you know. Well, I think ultimately it really does come down to what you value. I mean, if you value the presumption of innocence, because ultimately, and you know, people say, well, what about, you know, you're just doing it because you're worried about you being protected. Well, yeah, I have every right to worry about being protected, so why wouldn't I worry about that? And you worrying about the individual rights of yourself is also you worrying about the individual rights of everyone else. So it's not wrong to do that. But honestly, it really does just depend on your value system, in my opinion. What's your interpretation?
So there's two issues, the Kavanaugh thing in particular and the issue of different interpretations. So on the Kavanaugh thing, it wasn't a criminal proceedings. I think we have to distinguish, you know, there was an issue of him going to jail, but there is an issue of is there any evidence, and given how much evidence there is, if there is any, what's the right view to have of this guy? Should he be promoted to the Supreme Court or not?
I agree with you, it wasn't a criminal proceeding, but what they were suggesting were criminal charges.
Yes, if I think I can't prove that you did some criminal act, but I have pretty good evidence that might impact my dealings with you. Sure. And so I think the charges, there was some evidence. I think her testimony counts as some evidence. I think what one had to do, I think it shouldn't have been done in an open Senate hearing. It should have been done privately with an FBI investigation beforehand. But anyway, in some way or another, that evidence should have been weighed. I think the standard it would have had to have risen to deny him the Supreme Court seat, I think the standard the senator should have used is a standard of preponderance of the evidence. And I myself don't think that it met the standard of the preponderance of the evidence. But I also think that everyone involved in the hearing, including Kavanaugh himself and including the Democrats prosecuting him and some of the Republicans defending him, behaved rather badly. And in light of that, I'm not pleased that he got the seat in the end, but I'm also very worried about people who are going to continue to protest about it. And I really hope that the Democrats don't, like, you know, call for an investigation. I think it's wrong. Now, as to the issue of the multiple interpretations, I think what one... It's true. People are reading it through this ideological lens of the Republicans are always trying to get these white males in, and these white males are from an oppressive, preppy subculture that they're the kind of people who would just rape someone. So there's this kind of view going on the left. And you could see the way he's defending himself. He's talking like an entitled rapist would, right? So you get this kind of prism that it's being viewed from. And then the other prism it's being viewed from is the whole of the left is a mob that's always out to smear and character assassinate. And so we shouldn't pay any attention to what any of them say. So, and they're all, again, this monolith doing it. And I think there's some of what each side is accusing the other of on the other side in some cases. But I think one really has to make an effort oneself and then to encourage other people to think, well, what are the actual facts here? What are the actual... How should we think about each issue separately as individuals trying to think about it and try not to read it through this filter of here's what we think about the other side and what they're up to.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.